great talking to you, Elise. I can't wait to work with you. Yeah, the Dear Distance Guru column. It's really raised my profile. I'm glad you noticed it. I got to go, though. I got to record the podcast. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Boy's got utter belief in it.
And somehow she's found the acceleration.
Welcome to the Let'sRun.com Track Talk podcast. Huge weekend of track and field and marathoning to break down for you guys. Perez Jepchirchir and Alexander Mutiso are your London Marathon champions, and the running world is buzzing because Kenny Sabekele finished second and might be going back to the Olympics at age 41. On the other end of the age spectrum, Christian Miller has made history as the youngest person ever to break 10 seconds. He ran 9.93 in Claremont at the tender age of 17. And Courtney Lindsay has beaten Litsil Tobogo in Nairobi, running 19.71 into a headwind. Former world champion Pierre-Ambroise Boss of France has been suspended for whereabouts failures. After retiring in December 2023, we'll talk about the timeline there. And USADA is at war with WADA. You're just getting bombarded by press release after press release in the Let'sRun.com inbox. And we'll take a little look ahead to this weekend. Could we see the first women's sub-14 5K ever at the Suzhou Diamond League in China? Should be a great episode. This is Jonathan Galt, joined as always by Weldon Johnson, co-founder of Let'sRun.com, and Robert Johnson, coach of the stars. Guys, good to have you on the show.
Great to be here. Other things we'll be talking about. Josh Kerr has opened up impressively his outdoor campaign. Should Jakob be scared? U.S. 5,000 and 10,000 meter champion Elise Cranny is coachless yet again. Who should coach her? Elise, guys, the conversation at the beginning of the podcast was fake, but if you do need a coach, John Kellogg and I are here, willing to make it work. And what makes this podcast so great is you, our listeners, unlike Facebook, unlike Twitter, unlike Google, we want to hear from you. We have a phone number. Pick up the phone and give us a call. 844-LET'S-RUN. 844-538-7786. And if you don't give us a call, hey, you got to do something for us. We need voicemails, but you can always review your shoe that you're running in. Go to betterrunningshoes.com, betterrunningshoes.com.
Wait a second. Can we get a fact check on that one? Robert said, what makes this podcast great is you, our listeners. Well, I was always told what makes this podcast great is Robert Johnson. So is Rojo changing his tune? Do we have a humble Rojo? Is that going to be a good podcast anymore?
John, a dose of humility is good for everyone. Rojo has probably just been inspired by the greatness in track and field this week. Wander Duplantis, his 8th world record to start off the Diamond League season. We have a 17-year-old American, Christian Miller, leading the world 100-meter list. Mark Zuckerberg going sub-21 in 5K. But the place we have to start, TCS London Marathon, Kenny Sabekele at the age of 41, running 2:04 to finish second place. I woke up Sunday morning. I thought the race was over. I just checked the app and I saw atop the app, Kenny Sabekele, 2:03:06. I'm like, oh my God, he did it. I couldn't believe it. I was like, he did it. I kept scrolling down more. There was another guy at 2:03:06. I'm like, oh my God, a sprint finish? I couldn't believe it. And then I realized, oh my God, the race is still going. This is the 35K split. Turned it on. Of course, he's immediately getting dropped, but this was so awe-inspiring to me, to a lot of people. I mean, there's a guy on the Let's Run forums, I'll link to this, who suffers from depression. And essentially, he's like, the Kaylee makes me want to wake up and live every day.
It was incredible, Weldon. And I always say on this podcast, I don't root for athletes, but this race made it hard for me not to root for Bekele just because I want to see him at the Olympics. I think it would be really exciting to see 21 years after he battled Eliud Kipchoge in the 5,000 meter final of the 2003 World Championships in Paris, to see them again at the top of their sport, duking it out for the Olympic marathon gold on the streets of Paris. It would just be really cool. And I just respect the hell out of Bekele for going for this. You know, he shows up, he knows he needs to run fast and or win the race in London to make the Ethiopian Olympic team. And there he is, pushing the pace, throwing in a surge in the second half, dropping everyone except for Alexander Mutiso. And he left it all out there. They were basically jogging to the finish line because they were so exhausted. If you look at Bekele's splits, just he was running about, I think, 2:14 pace to the finish from 35K. But think how close we were to having him guarantee. Like, we were 7 kilometers away from him running. He was on 2:03.06 pace and winning the London Marathon. Like, could you imagine if he had done that at age 41? Would have gone down as one of his all-time greatest victories. And to finish second in 2:04.15, Masters world record, still got a decent shot of making the Olympic team. But it was thrilling theater on Sunday morning.
I watched it. I used the word watch in quotation marks slightly differently. And I need to remind our younger viewers, there's some people that grew up in another, they're not into message boards. The best way to follow these races, still 24 years after the founding of Let's Run, is the Let's Run Live message board thread. We need to get with the programmer. We need to get make it a commitment on Let's Run for every event. Maybe it's letsrun.com/watch or TV or replay. But there's a page where you can go to where you know the official thread will be linked to. And you also know there'll be no spoilers on the page. And if the race is already over, because that's how I watched the race. The night before, I went to bed, you know, 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock, whatever. And I thought, okay, I'm not getting up at 4, but I don't want to have it spoiled. I want the excitement of discovering it. Sometimes you can just go to the message board, I mean, the front page, and get it all at once. But I was like, no, I want to see it play by play. So I had left the computer on the official thread. And when I opened it up, I went to that thread and hit refresh. Now, the way it's currently set up, you've got to be careful because when you get to the bottom of the thread, it's going to have the 10 most popular threads and somebody will be going, but gaga if Bekele won it. Well, I was reading it and it's okay, crazy fast women's start, everyone's there. Then men's race starts, Bekele's up there. Everyone's like, he's looking really good. At one point, one guy said he looked tired. People are like, no, he's not, he looks fine. And then I was like, oh my God. And I got really excited, like, Weldon. At one point, I thought, I almost like ran into the other room and thought, we've got to put a black page up and just start a live emergency podcast. I'm like, I wonder if they're doing it right now. You know, it's like 8 o'clock. Race was probably over around 7, I guess. And then I kept reading. And I'll admit the coach and me, if I was coaching every pro, it'd be the boringest race ever because you would do none of the work. I would leech off everybody else. They're like, Bekele's pushing the pace. And I was like, that's a mistake. Don't be pushing the pace. And then he ended up second. So people on the live thread in the future, back in the day, we used to make sure everyone would post like the halfway split. That would have been useful. I think that was left out because people are just assuming everyone's watching it. There are people like me watching it hours after the fact. But I think if we have this page with the link to the live thread, and then after it, if we can find like any full race replays or maybe even like the finish replay, that has no spoiler awards. Like it just needs to be London Marathon full race replay instead of like, you can't say Bekele wins. We would also embed it on this page. So, you know, because people could just, if they can't watch these races at obscure times of the day, but they could go to this Let's Run page. And I think a few hundred, a few thousand people would enjoy it greatly.
It was very cool to see. And it wasn't something even about 6 months ago, I thought we would ever really see again. Honestly, 6 months ago, I think I thought Bekele was done. I remember you asking me, Robert, before the Valencia Marathon to reach out to his agent, Jos Hermans, and say, you know, can we get an update? Bekele's running Valencia. Like, what do we expect? I'm like, what do I expect? The guy's basically cooked. Like, he DNF London in 2023. He was fifth there in 2022, ran 2:05, but he had a new sponsor, Anta, last year after 20 years with Nike. And I just kind of assumed, you know, he'd show up, but he hadn't really been close to winning one of these majors since he won Berlin in 2019. And he turns up to Valencia, he runs 204.19. Suddenly it's like, okay, he's on the fringe of the Olympic discussion, but he really needs like another strong race. And then he goes to the New York City Half Marathon in March, runs 63.59, finishes seventh place. And I'm just like, well, okay, that's horrible. And he's like, yeah, it's a bad race. I still think I'm about 50-50 to make the Olympic team. I'm like, 50-50? You're going to run way faster than this pace for a whole marathon, buddy. And he had all these explanations like, oh, yes, the travel over from Ethiopia wasn't great to New York. And, you know, the food, I had an upset stomach. And I'm like, okay, how much credence do we lend these? Apparently, we should lend them credence because he goes to London. He was ready to go. He went for it. He ran terrific. His best marathon in years. It was just awesome to see. And the guy's not cooked. And I think the other thing to say about this, he has a pretty good chance to make the Olympic team. We had an insider from Ethiopia text us today and give us some insight into the selection procedures for the Olympic marathon. And they said, the official criteria is you need two good results in the selection period. Experience and previous success matters a lot. So the thinking was, well, two recent good marathons, Tamarat Tola DNF'd Worlds and DNF'd London, even though he won New York in a course record in between. So that hurts him. But who does it help? Candice Bekele, because he just ran well in Valencia and he finished as the top Ethiopian second overall in London. So this source said Bekele is very likely on the team, which is very, it's fascinating. I can't wait to see the selections.
So this tip, John says you need two races to win.
In this selection period, two good results.
And when did the Road to Paris selection criteria start?
Right after the 2022 New York City Marathon, I believe, like November 2022.
So that doesn't mean, so basically, after the race ended, I immediately spent like 3 or 4 hours like making the case for and against Bekele. And we'll link to that in the show notes.
I mean, Tola still has some good races during the selection period. He was third in London in 2023 in 204.59. He also was fourth in Valencia in 2022, December 2022, 203.40. But if they're going by like more recent races, well, Tola has DNF'd two of his last three. And I think that... who do I think is more likely to have success in the Olympic marathon? I think it's Tamarat Tola, but... that might not be the criteria for picking him onto the team ahead of Bekele.
Yeah, but I was just going to say, you know, based on that, Tola is not eliminated because he does have two solid marathons in the window. Looking historically at it, it looks like Ethiopia has often put a lot of weight in their last marathon. So, you know, Bekele has not been in the Olympics since 2012, but in 2016, it was a bit tough because I don't think Bekele raced at all in 2015. He was injured. And then he got like third in London. And then they left him off, but I was looking at it like they didn't do something stupid. They picked like the Boston champ, the Tokyo champ, and the Dubai champ. I mean, it wasn't like they went out of their way to screw him over. And then in 2021, you know, COVID, he wasn't really racing, didn't really have a... by the way, Ethiopia had three DNFs at the Olympics in 2021.
They had a trials and he didn't run them. And I think he might've been coming off of injury and was worried he wasn't going to be able to perform at his best. But you can't the way they rolled out that trials announced it, it was botched. It was not a good, smooth process at all, but he did not run the trials.
So it's either going to be... John and I basically think it's either Cisse Limet, who won Valencia and won Boston's on the team.
He's on the team.
And then you've got two of the following three people: Candice Bekele, Tamarat Tola, the New York City record holder, and then this newcomer, I would say, Derese Gilette, who ran one Seville earlier this year in 203.27. Now you see 203.27 And that's obviously faster than what Bekele ran. But, and he's got a few other, you know, things besides that. So last year he also was second in Dubai in 205.51 in February and first in Beijing in 207.41. So he's got, you know, three solid races. All of them have been solid. But the argument that I made in the week that was, you know, if you just go by time, I don't think that's fair in any event. Like, conditions make a huge difference. And what we've seen in London recently, particularly Sunday, is a super fast start, and then everyone can't handle it, and they've slowed down massively in the second half. But I think if they had a slower start and better weather, they could run faster. And the Seville race was absolutely wild, how everyone in the race basically ran a huge PB on the men's side. I think it was like 15 of the top 16 finishers all ran a personal best. And the average personal best was by 1 minute and 51 seconds. And even if you include the person who did run slower, it's still 1 minute and 40 seconds. So this was like a perfect day. London was not perfect. A, the start was probably too fast, and B, it was windy. And, you know, the wind makes an impact. So it's just like sprint times. We know that the wind makes an impact. So I think you could make the argument that second in London, beating a stacked, most of the guys in the stacked field, is better than first in Seville, even though it's a slower time. So, you know, it'll be interesting. Who do they pick between them? And the thing that made me feel good was, I'm like, if they're going off of time, Bekele has the nod over the other two. If they're going off of...
Well, no, he has the nod over Tola. Galeta has run faster, like you just
said. Over Tola. And if they're going off sort of stature and like performance in big races, I think Tola and Bekele have the edge over the other guy. So it would be hard for me to see them taking him off, since it's borderline case and he's the GD goat. Like, I think if you're a selector, you're going to be, no one's going to criticize you for putting Bekele on the team. They might criticize you for putting Galeta, you know, who has never won a major in his life. As I said, do you not think Kenenisa Bekele would win the Beijing Marathon if he showed up at it?
Looking at the London race, just how it played out, I thought it was pretty wild, because the halfway split was 61:29, which I don't get fazed by seeing that at all. I'm like, I kind of expect that in London, honestly, like 203 flat pace. I'm sure, you know, every year I bet there are guys who can run 203 flat. But on Sunday, that did prove to be unsustainably fast, because it seems like the wind really was a factor. This was something that some of the athletes who did finish spoke about afterwards. Just the carnage, there was a group of 10 men at halfway in 61:30. Half of them dropped out of the race. Another one of them, Seifu Tura, he must have been walking or something at the end, because he ended up running 2:36. And that's like a 90 plus minute second half. And then the only guys who held on remotely well were the guys who went 1-2, Alexander Matiso and Kenenisa Bekele, because third place was Emil Keres, the Brit, and he did not go out with the leaders. He ends up running 2:06.46. He's still positive split a little bit. He hit halfway in 62:50, and he was talking about the wind afterwards, but he still held on very well. And they were saying on the broadcast, he may not even have known he was in third place, because so many of these guys in front of him were dropping out. You know, five of the guys who were in front of him at halfway dropped out of the race. So he crossed the finish line. Great run for him. Fastest ever by a British-born athlete. Number two among all Brits behind Mo Farah. And then fourth place as well for Great Britain, Mohamed Mohamed, who runs 2:07.05, gets the Olympic standard. He's going to Paris. So it was a wild second half of the race. I think it has to be due to the weather, but due to the wind, because the temperatures, it wasn't that sunny, and the temperature was perfect for marathoning.
Okay, the talk of Bekele being 50-50 to make the Olympic team in New York, that was crazy. It just shows how he's at another whole nother level. Because I was thinking now maybe it's 50-50. I'm going to bump it up a bit. Maybe two-thirds, you know, 75% of the team. I think he makes the team now. Because there's a chance they leave Tola off. I pretty much was putting Tola on the team. And then I just said, like, it's a toss-up between Goetta and Bekele. But the wind argument's pretty convincing to me. But Bekele, he just does stuff that no one else does. Like, anyone else, I mean, I talked to him in New York, and he did point it aside to his agent. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe there's something going on with his stomach. And you've seen him just, obviously, throughout his career, do stuff that no one's done before. But in, like, 2019, he ran one race all year. It was a 201.41 marathon. I mean, this guy just pulls stuff. I'm kind of putting this on that level. You know, you're fast forwarding, what, 5 years? And to drop a 204 in windy conditions? Pretty amazing.
I just think Bekele's marathon career has been such an odyssey. You know, he debuts in Paris in 2014 and runs 205.04. I'm like, okay, this guy was the GOAT on the track. I expect him to be really good at the marathon. He won that race and he made it look pretty easy. And then that fall, he goes to Chicago and I'm like, all right, he might get the world record. He's going to run something really fast. I overlooked another guy in the field by the name of Eliud Kipchoge. I was like, oh yeah, Bekele, he'll definitely show up there. Kipchoge wins that race. And I'm like, oh, actually, could Kipchoge be better than Bekele in the marathon? Then there were a couple times he shows up to Dubai, and one of them he trips at the start line. The record attempt, you know, is done before it even gets going. He goes to London a few times, gets left off the Olympic team in 2016, shows up to Berlin, wins that 203.03, 6 seconds shy of the world record. And then you're like, wow, Bekele's back. And then he goes back to Dubai again, DNF. London, second, goes to Berlin, DNF, goes to Amsterdam the next year, DNF with a, you know, a couple miles to go. And within this whole time, like, people are like, is he ever going to really fully realize this potential in the marathon? And it, you know, most notably his own agent Jos Hermans, who after the 2017 Berlin marathon, he called him out. You remember, I called him after the race and we just talked about it, and he was like, you know, he's got to go all in. He's got to train seriously for this all around. He needs to be more professional about it. Like, I thought that whole exchange was wild. And then they sort of reconcile and, you know, they mend their relationship. But the whole time, I'm just like, is this guy ever going to put it together? And then 2019, age 39, he shows up, sorry, not 39, he was 37, shows up to Berlin, runs 201.41, 2 seconds off of Kipchoge's world record. And that just reminds you how talented this guy is, how good he is when he actually does get some healthy training in, because he's had injuries the whole time. And then for a while, like, that might be his last great moment. And now it looks like that long winding odyssey that has been a decade in the making could end up with him running the Olympic marathon for the first time in Paris in August 2024 at age 42. It's been fascinating to follow, and I think it would only be appropriate if he says he wants to run for another 2 or 3 years. He set off to London, but to him to get to the Olympics would be just crazy.
I just hope they make a decision right away. I mean, but a year or two ago, Hermans also said, I signed him up for a bunch of races to keep him motivated. Like, he needs to know right away. I would put him on the team. Obviously, he could get hurt. He's had a lot of injury problems, so you have the other guys train as well. I don't think Bekele's just going to go if he's injured and just waste a spot just to, like, you know, if he knows he has no shot. I think he would do the, you know, it's not like he needs to say he's an Olympian, right? And I was thinking that, I don't know. If I'm Miss Electro, I guess I put him on just because I want to see him do it. But, like, let's just say they were named runner A and runner B and runner C. Would you put them on? But it also just depends on how you're doing it. Like, are you making some objective thing? Oh, this person's younger. I think they're going to do better. Who deserves to be on the team better? And I would argue it's really close between him and that Goetta guy. But I was thinking Goetta might have a better chance of winning the race than Bekele. You know, if you're second in London, though, and you're fourth in Valencia, you got a real good shot at medley.
I mean, Matiso's a 203 flat guy, and Bekele, I mean, Matiso did hold on better, but Bekele was right with him, 35K. I mean, it's just, oh, that lost. Like, if it was, I'd like to know if it wasn't, what happens in London if it wasn't windy? Do all these other guys hang on and suddenly he's fifth? Or does Bekele himself hang on and he runs 203, you know, and wins the race? It's just, we can only go with what happened, but it's interesting to consider.
Yeah, for the record, Alexander Matiso is your men's London Marathon champion. He was second in Valencia last year, so he's totally legit.
He'll be on the Olympic team for Kenya, I'm pretty sure. Because my guess now, it's going to be him, Benson Kipruto, and Kipchoge. And Evans Chebet's probably going to get left out. Any final thoughts on Bekele? Or should we move to the women's race in London, which was also compelling in its own way?
My other way takeaway from London is people aren't going to want to hear it. The U.S. men just are not very good at marathoning. John, your other country? Well, they already had one qualifier, but Emil Karas, 206.46, Mohamed Mohamed, 207.05, both easily under the automatic Olympic qualifying standard by over a minute, and it's windy? Like, it's just crazy to me. Like, we're not even coming close. I shouldn't harp on this all the time, but it's just a sort of reminder. Like, I think we're going to have three guys at the Olympic team. Winning career shown he can run well. He's shown he can run well in the past. But you can't argue, like, there's something wrong with the system and they're, you know, it's too hard to make. They're taking 80 guys to the Olympics, three per country. And the U.S. here on the, you know, 23rd hour, it's still up in the air.
No, I don't think the Olympic marathon standard is too hard. I think just many of America's best marathon talents are still on the track. Emil Karas, terrific runner, coached by Renato Canova. He went to Kenya for his build-up. Canova, super hot thread on the message board right now is Renato Canova just posted his entire build-up on the message board. Awesome stuff if you're a real running junkie. But Karas is 26 years old. He's a few months younger than Grant Fisher. Many Americans at this point in their career would just still be on the track. And I guess Connor Mance is one who's moved up fairly early. But, you know, Joe Klecker, Woody Kincaid's in his 30s and still running on the track. I think if more of America's top guys went to the marathon earlier, you would have a few under the standard. I'm not sure. I mean, 206 is terrific. But I think the U.S. is more of a track-focused country than America. Do you think that's a fair assessment? Or is this just making an excuse?
I think you've got a point. I think if we had all of our best runners run the marathon, we would have several under the standard. But to me, I think the marathon is where and I'm not saying that all Americans are like Caucasian, but we're sort of, that's the event we do, Caucasian, which is still the majority in this country, do the worst at. I think they're better at the shorter events. And I also do think that there's some privilege in the sense of a lot of Americans make a lot of money with their shoe contracts. They don't need to run the marathon. For the rest of the world, that's not true. And one of these guys I was looking up, potential Ethiopian Olympian, I forgot which one it was. This guy won the world junior silver medalist in the steeplechase like 2 years ago. He's run like under 8:10 in the steeple. He's already running like the marathon because they don't get $200,000 a year shoe contracts in Ethiopia and they want to put food on the table. But speaking of competitiveness and what events America's good at, this is going to be a sidetrack for a minute, guys. I meant to bring this up on the podcast the other day. You know, when we were talking about, they're like, America just sucked at distance running for a long time. Now they're finally competitive. And I'm not saying, hey, when we came up in the sport, the U.S. didn't really suck at the end of the late 90s, early 2000s. That's true, but one thing that may be making the U.S. more competitive, and I'm not saying there haven't been dopers in U.S. history. There have been. Mary Slaney was busted. She's one of the most, you know, prominent teen prodigies in American history. I've just posted the 1500 meters at the Olympics. It was striking. Well, I think Americans might be more competitive now on the track. Is, well, this wouldn't explain the marathon, those, but like, they're catching more dopers. I was looking at the Olympic 1500 meter list. I don't even need to make you guys do the game. But look at that list right now. And I was like, if you ask me, I looked at the last 8 Olympic 1500 meter champions. And I was like, okay, put a gun to my head. I think 5 of them were dopers. 5 out of 8. And then I historically, you know, growing up was not following. I'm not as familiar with the, full disclosure, women's 1500 meter champions. If you just look at that list, look at these countries. Soviet Union, Italy, Romania, Algeria, Russia, Algeria, Great Britain, Kenya, Bahrain, Kenya. Of the 13 Olympic champions, okay, I will have to do that. How many of those people would you think are clean? 13 gold medals, 1. I've got my answer in my head. Tell me when you have your answers, then I'll say on the count of 3, we yell out how many are clean.
Okay, Robert, I have my number.
Okay, pulling up this list. Wait a second. Oh my God. Okay, I'm ready.
Actually, can I revise my number? Holy crap. Okay, I'm going to say 1, 2, 3, and then we yell out how many we have the 13 golds we think were probably by clean athletes. Ready? 1, 2, 3, 4.
3.
I was thinking of going down to 2, actually.
Robert, I had the same thing. I could go as low as 2, but...
And that would be Kip Yeagon.
4, I'm giving the benefit of the doubt.
Last 2, I'd feel confident and wouldn't hesitate saying Kip Yeagon's clean. And I know people are going to be like, but she's the fastest. How could she be clean and all those be dirty? That's just what I'm thinking. I think she's a child prodigy. It was amazing and barefoot. These others, just based on countries alone, almost all of them are totally suspicious.
Oh, we're counting Kip Yeagon twice?
Yes.
Dude, she counts for 2 gold medals. So I was thinking of the total gold medals. 2 of those 4, yeah, belong to Kip Yeagon.
I was up to 4 as well then. No need for names. Everyone look at the list. We'll probably agree on the 4 names.
All right. Getting back on track after that incredible tangent. Let's talk about the women's race in London. This is where we're at in the year 2024, that you can have a tactical 2:16 marathon. It's a women's only world record. The top 4 women all broke 2:17.01, which was the previous women's only world record by Mary Kitani. Perez Jepchirchir, the Olympic champion, is your winner, 2:16.16. And she hung in there, and then very interesting moment. They're coming down Birdcage Walk. They're making the right towards Buckingham Palace. And Teeks DeCeffa is trying to move in front of Perez Jepchirchir to get the inside line on the turn. Jepchirchir doesn't like it, kind of shoves her a little bit. And then she just says, screw this. I can just start sprinting. She goes wide and immediately opens up this gap, goes on to win by 7 seconds. Pretty reminiscent of her victories in New York in 2022 and Boston. Sorry, New York in 2021, Boston in 2022. Both of those were kicks in the home straight as well. So we're saying, you know, who beats Helen O'Beary in a kick at the Olympic marathon? Could it be Safwan Hassan? I think you've got to also consider Perez Jepchirchir. And now I will say this, Perez Jepchirchir was outkicked by Safwan Hassan in London last year, but generally when she's on, you know, she is very difficult to beat in a kick. She's the world half marathon champ. She's the reigning Olympic champ. I still have O'Beary as a slight favorite in the Olympic marathon, but Jepchirchir's marathon track record is just absurd. She ran 2 of them in Kenya when she was younger, was 3rd in each of them, but she really moved to the marathon in the end of 2019. She's made 7 starts. And she's won 6 of them. 1st Saitama, 1st Valencia, 1st Olympics, 1st New York, 1st Boston, 3rd London, 1st London. She's just incredible. It's good to see her healthy again. Remember, she had to scratch from New York last year at the 11th hour due to a calf injury. But taking down the world record holder Teague Sesefa and running 2:16.16 in London in a quote-unquote tactical race, that sent a statement.
I'm glad you point out her stats, John. Those are amazing. I'd love to see the betting odds. I feel like she honestly, Jip Tirtcher, she's a defending champion. She's won like all but one of her marathons in her career. I mean, O'Beary's won all but one, which is 3 out of 4. So I think Jip Tirtcher should be the betting favorite. But it's going to be close. I think there could be some money to be made on this thing. They're both proven on hilly courses. So that's exciting.
I wanted your take on Teague Sesefa, Robert, because she shows up to this race and going in, we're wondering, like, is she just way better than everyone else? She runs 2:11.53 in Berlin. And does this change your perception of her? Do you think that she still, you know, in a rabbited race, she's still going to be way better than everyone else, and she's just not quite as good when it is a slightly slower run and it comes down to a kick? Or do you think we could see O'Beary and Jep Chia, maybe Safan Hassan, run 2:11 or 2:12 if they get in a race like we saw in Berlin last fall?
The latter. Rich already said O'Beary could run that. So I believe him. Like, I don't, you know, if you're an Ethiopian trying to wonder why Bekele didn't run 2:03, the fact that the women were slowing down too just shows it wasn't a good day to run fast. And maybe she's more vulnerable on a kick. I don't know. But I know Weldon wants to say a few more things about the actual race. One thing I would like to see is, I don't know, I'm just playing it both ways because people got to complain. Remember a couple years, I was going to say, I'm tired of seeing the same London race every single damn year. And I guess last year was exciting. Hassan came back and outkicked everybody. But it seems to me we're seeing the same race in the sense of they set an overly ambitious pace with the rabbits. Everyone slows down. And it's a war of attrition. I'd like to see some strategy, some tactics. To me, Boston is way more fascinating, way more interesting to watch. Although watching it on a nowadays broadcast, I mean, it's clear that the race organizers don't care about the TV product. They don't care about the interesting thing. But someone listen to me. Hire me to be your events guy. Like, New York should have up, you know, Comrades has up and down years. They should have rabbited and unrabbited. Maybe World Athletics should mandate that you can only rabbit 50% of the races or something, because we're getting the same race every year and I don't like it. But this was a fun sprint finish. But they didn't listen to us. What did we say in the podcast? We said the opening pace should be 68:30. That's the women's world record, 2:17.01, and then hopefully they can pick it up off that. Instead, they went out a full minute faster than that, right, John?
They went out, yeah, 67 flat, essentially. But
a minute and a half faster.
You know, I think what happened was, what has often happened in these things, the paces drop out, and yes, people were talking about the record, and they did break the women's only world record easily, but you don't think one of those women was feeling good and could have taken off at some point? They just start worrying about the win instead of worrying about the time. And that's fine with me. I don't mind seeing them battle it out. They waited a very long time. Like, you know, it's rare you see four women together with like a mile to go in a world marathon major. But I didn't really mind how the race played out. And honestly, sometimes the carnage in London can be fun to watch. You know, it kind of reminds you, hey, the marathon actually is hard. And if you go out aggressively, you get punished. I remember Emmanuel Mutai winning, I think it was 2013 in London, where everyone just goes out really hard and he's the one guy who kind of survives. And he might have even run people down. I think that was the year I'm thinking of. And this one as well, what's unfortunate, and a lot of people were complaining about, is like the men's broadcast, you didn't really get to see the carnage unfold. What they had this big pack, and then suddenly we cut to it, and it's just Bekele and Mutiso. And you're like, where the hell did all these guys go? They were all together like a couple miles ago. So it's actually interesting to me, and I kind of enjoy that instead of everyone just hanging on and running really fast, we do actually get to see people get punished in the second half of a marathon for going out too hard.
I'm probably just going to complain no matter what they do. But part of the reason why people don't care about dropping out is the prize money is so low. They have huge appearance fees. And then it's like 10 grand for second, or, you know, 10 grand for fifth or something ridiculous. But then on the other hand, if you had huge prize money, then people would play it safe. They couldn't afford to go for broke. It would be kind of, you'd have the same boring conservative race every year. So you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. But are you telling me, John, that it's shocker that another marathon broadcast wasn't great to watch on TV? Now, it's my understanding that BBC, if you can find the right BBC, they have elite men, elite women only. But they face an impossible task. London did not used to start the women in front. They did it this year. But if anyone starts in front, it needs to be the men so that they finish even farther in front. And again, race directors, you want to have your elite race of one sex ending when the other sex is roughly at halfway. Then you can basically broadcast both races in their entirety, not miss anything. You don't need to show these wheelchair races. You can say that the able-bodied races aren't that popular. Fair enough. But I know the wheelchair putt races are totally unpopular. So anyone that's trying to watch the actual marathon broadcast doesn't want to watch that.
Right. I don't think the issue was they were showing the women's race when they should have been showing the men so much as they were showing like the mass race. And they showed a lot of the wheelchair coverage earlier as well. But yeah, the broadcast team in London, Steve Cram and Paula Radcliffe, do a phenomenal job. They're both very well informed. They do a good job in the commentary. It was annoying to see them miss that separation in the men's race.
We need to have a rule. We can't complain about the broadcast. Or we're going to email them suggestions or something. Just ranting on a podcast is...
Well, then, you always say that, but I've written the articles with suggestions. And I give the Diamond League, how to make the Diamond League more popular. I do write these articles. Just nothing changes.
John had the best summary of the women's race. It was a 2:16 tactical race. And there's four women essentially kicking for the win. So my condolences to Majurtu Elimu, fourth place, 2:16.34. I don't think if you roll the dice differently, she actually wins this race, but I could see the other three winning it.
Do you have any thoughts on the shove, Weldon, after your video analysis?
It's good. I like it. I'm actually kind of, you see some like 90-pound woman do a shove, but Perez, good for you. It wasn't enough to get DQ'd, but God, there's not like VAR and the London Marathon. Maybe there is. Oh, John. They bring the VAR people. Heard he's a Luton fan. What if the VAR person was a Suffolk fan? Would Jim Churcher have been disqualified? 1-844, let's run.
Yeah, big run for Jocelyn Jepkosgei as well in third. You know, if she was only 8 seconds out for the win. If she wins this race, she's probably on the Olympic team. She's won New York before in the past. She won London in 2021. As it is, I think she'll probably get left. Well, I guess, yeah, the final spot we were debating for the Kenyan Olympic marathon team on the women's side, if you're assuming Obiri and Jepchirchir are on there, you would have a debate between Sharon Lokedi, who was second in London, and
Boston.
Sorry, Boston, and Rosemary Wanjiru, who was second in Tokyo in 2:16.14, which, yeah, we don't need to go through the whole debate there, but, you know, it is wild that Jepkosgei runs 2:16.24, and she's probably going to be on the outside looking in.
All right, enough London Marathon talk. Can we talk a little Diamond League? Now, we're not going to rehash the whole Diamond League meet, because we had a recap show on Saturday for Supporters Club members. If you're a hardcore track and field fan, you need to be a Supporters Club member. You get a second podcast every week. We recap the whole Diamond League meet. You get a super soft running shirt. Rojo pretty much guarantees your significant other will want to sleep with you if we wear this thing. That's a different issue. You can save right now like 15% on most running shoes. It's a great club. Join today. Let'srun.com/subscribe. Use code CLUB25 to save 25%. But the performance of the weekend from the Let's Run perspective was Gudolf Sagai's 350.30, 1500 opener. I mean, Faith Kipyegon's 349, I thought was going to last maybe for a long time. I think the thing's going down this year now. So I don't know if you guys have any more thoughts on this race, but the other thing we got from our source about the Ethiopian marathon team is a very official looking document sort of showing like the provisional list for each event. Gudaf Sagai is only listed on the 10,000 meters. And there's also a rubber stamped seal on this. Like, I think that has to make it official. The United States needs to start doing that again. We need don't just print out documents. You need the official person with the authority to stamp it to show that this is official.
Rise of the notaries. Bring them back, baby. Yeah, I saw this. It was interesting. But I remember last year talking to Sagai, I think it was in Budapest. She seemed as if she wanted to triple at the Olympics if the Federation would let her. And she has doubled pretty well for them in the past. I know the 5K last year in Budapest didn't go well for her. But in 2022, she got gold in the 5K and silver in the 1500. So it's going to be interesting to see what she does. I also just got a press release as we're recording. She's going for the 10,000 meter world record in Eugene at the pre-classic next month. So I think if I'm Sagai, it might depend on the health status of Faith Kipyegon, because Faith Kipyegon was supposed to run this meet in Xiamen on Saturday, and then she withdrew, and Robert, apparently they said on the broadcast it was some sort of muscle injury, it was minor. If you've got a full-strength Faith Kipyegon, Robert had an amazing start in the week that was. Kipyegon never loses to Sagai. She's 15-0 against her in her career. If we've got Kipyegon showing her normal form going into the Olympics and I'm Sagai, I would just probably skip the 1500 and focus on the two longer events. But I'd love to see her try all three. I'd love to see Kipyegon, you know, maybe Hassan even try all three as well.
Oh my God, I didn't know what y'all were talking about, this inside source. I just looked at this WhatsApp message with these entries for the... Are they going to have a trials race for the 10, 15, and 5?
I don't know, Robert.
But this would be so, so stupid for Ethiopia to only let her run one event, or for her to only run one event. At a minimum, she needs to run two. And if Kipyegon's not going for the triple, I think she should go for the triple. Now, I looked at the schedule, and I wrote about this in the week that was. The way it's set up, despite the 350-30, I don't think she's going to run the 1500 at the Olympics, because the way it goes is 5,000 first round and final are done before anything else starts. Then you got the first two rounds of the 1500, 10,000 final, 1500 final on back-to-back nights. So, if Kipyegon's in there, Sagai's not going to beat her in the 1500 the night after the 10,000 final if Sagai ran the 10,000 Kipyegon did. So, I would just skip the 1500, but she could still medal, I think. And how do you not run two events? This is the woman that won, is the world record holder in the 5,000 meters. She's run 14:01. So, she's running Eugene. I think she's going to be the first woman under 29 flat. She could also be the first woman under 14 flat. My God, she's almost the world record holder at all three. She definitely has to run the 10 and the 5. And then, why not run the 1500 as well? But one event? Like, just because she told us last year something, I forgot what she said about...
Let's just jump in, though. Like, imagine USATF had a committee that was picking the Olympic team. And then Max Siegel put a stamp of approval, a seal of approval on the list. Right now, that list would be so far off. It would be so inaccurate. People would be doubling. It would be wrong, right? Like, think of just what they did with the qualifying for the Olympic marathon. We kept getting different documents put out and all sorts of stuff. So I'm not taking this document to really mean she won't try a double. Although the Ethiopians, more so than any other federation, have been reluctant to let people double. So I'm not viewing this document that was definitive at this time by any stretch of the imagination.
They've been reluctant, but they've also, the last few championships, they've let their stars try it. Berega has doubled, Aragawi has doubled, Sagai has doubled the last two worlds. Getnet Wale, they let him double in the steeple in the 5K. If you're like one of the very top, top guys or girls in an event, I think they'll let you do it. My prediction is Sagai will run at least two events in Paris.
But one thing in looking at that schedule, seeing the 1500 the night after the 10,000 final, and also the day before the marathon. I thought it was great news for any American or Australian or British woman that were hoping to medal in the 1500. You may be the 10th best 1500 meter, 8th best 1500 meter runner in the world, but you still may end up with an Olympic medal because Sagai and Hassan very well may not run the 1500. I would love to have Kipyegon, Hassan, and Sagai try to sweep all 9 miles, as I said on Friday, but they'll probably opt for other events if you ask me right now. And then I'm not convinced that the Ethiopians, the other girls not named Sagai, are all quite young. They seem kind of erratic in their performances. Another stat I came up with, like the fastest girl, the world indoor champ was only like, what, fourth or fifth in this Diamond League, and the people that were fourth or fifth in the indoors are now at the top. They're all over the place. They're going to probably race themselves into oblivion because there's not going to be a trials race. It's going to be chaos. So there is hope for the Americans somehow getting a medal. I mean, we got to remember Ellie St. Pierre did beat Gudloff Sagai at World Indoors, so God bless her for that. That was an amazing performance. So it's going to be fun to think about. John, we need to text our source back and ask, like, is there a trials race this year? I mean, they've had it in the 5 and 10, but they've never had it in the 1500, from I'm aware of.
No, 2021, they had it in every event, I think, maybe except the 5K. But they had, like, a trials in basically every event in 2021.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The other thing from Xiamen, I mean, we broke down the whole thing. And one of our takeaways was, like, no real need to panic for Sha'Carri Richardson. She gets second. She probably didn't see Tori Lewis, the 19-year-old Australian, in the outside lane. But the I thought over it a little bit more over the weekend, and I was just going back to last year. Sha'Carri Richardson started so fast last year. Like, what are her two best years of her pro career? 2021, when she opens up in a 10.72 PB on April 10th. And then last year, she opens up in a 10.57 wind aided on April 8th. And this year, she's opening up a little later, April 20th, and is a 200, which is not her best event. But she's running, and it wasn't a fast day for anyone, but she ran more than a second off her PB. I'm still not super concerned, but I think having had a little time to think about it, this is a woman who starts really fast and usually is ready to go when she starts competing. And it's a little concerning to me that she only ran 22.99 and gets beat by Tori Lewis. Am I off base here, Robert, or are you not worried because it's April?
Concerned would be the word I would use. You don't want to overreact, but it wasn't a good showing. I mean, to me, it's like, I'm kind of saying ignore the actual time and just see who they relative to other people, but much slower than I would have expected. And there's no indication here, oh, she's going to be at a better level than I ever thought before. Now, she's not a great 200 meter runner.
But she was bronze at Worlds last year, and she lost to a woman who has a PB of 22.94.
But didn't she beat someone who's run 22.2 this year? Tamara Clark, 22.21.
Yeah, she beat her. So I guess you can spin it whichever way you want it. Again, not massively concerned, but just it's worth noting that certainly not as strong as her openers in 21 or 23.
If you're a Sha'Carri fan, I'll give you three reasons why you shouldn't be panicking. Can you think of them, John, before I even say them? Can you read my mind? If not, I'll give you a hint, John. It's just three names.
Is it Sharika Jackson, Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce, Elaine Thompson-Herah?
Correct. And what do they all have in common?
They're all Jamaican, and none of them have raced this season.
Exactly. None of them have raced this season. So, for all we know, they're injured. Maybe they're trying to get their peak right, but we're getting to the point of the year when I'm like, if you're not running now, by now, it's making me a little bit nervous. If they're all injured, somebody has to win the gold medal. Maybe a Talu who ran a relay last week, or Julian Alfred, or Sha'Carri. I mean, last time I checked, John, they, you know, if you win the women's Olympic 100-meter title in like 10-9, they don't hand out a brown medal. It's still gold, right? I mean, when Kim,
what do you mean? The other thing is, if they're all injured, what? Sha'Carri won the gold medal last year in a championship record of the 100. They don't all need to be injured for her to win. She can absolutely beat them if they're at their best this year. Well, sort of. I'm kind of assuming that they're best for their point in their career right now, because I don't think we're going to see the Thompson Hurrah or the Shelly Ann Fraser Price from 2021. I don't think that version of those women is coming back.
No, my point is, she may not have to be in peak Sha'Carri. This opening day result, it does not look like it's peak Sha'Carri, and we're going to expect a PR this year. I'm not ruling it out. I don't worry. I want to see a second performance, but I'm a little bit worried.
Right.
And she may not need to peak to win, because, you know, the top four or five are way better than everybody else. They could be off a little bit off their game and still do it. These other women are significantly older than Sha'Carri. I mean, Shelly Ann Fraser Price is 37. So we'll see what happens there. And it's worth noting that the last time there was a global championship in the Stade de France in 2003, the winning time in the men's 100 meters, Kim Collins somehow won the world title in 10:07. They didn't take it away from being a relatively incredibly slow time. I'm not sure what happened that year.
Yeah, Sha'Carri is racing again in the 200 this upcoming weekend in Suzhou. And another race people are getting excited about on the message boards is the women's 5,000, which is not a Diamond League event. So there are people speculating, saying, is this a world record attempt for Letessa Mbakide, the former world record holder? Now she's number 4 on the all-time list after last year, 14:06. And the explanation, they're thinking, well, it's a non-Diamond League event before the TV window. And you've got some women in there. Winnie Nanyondo is one of them, pacing. And I think Sarah Billings, who the Aussie who just ran 3:59, they said she's pacing as well. They're saying, is this a world record attempt for Gide? It looks like they've got the wave light there as well. So I reached out to her agent, Valentine Trow, and he said, she'll run her first track race of the season this weekend. It's much more a first race to get the season going, not focusing for time. So he's trying not to play things up as a world record attempt. Do you buy that, Robert, or do you think this we could see a world record this first sub 14?
No world record. This seems crazy to me. Like, I saw this thread, and I'm like, oh, she's running the world record. This would be amazing. We got to make sure we got to hype this up. And then I read the thread, and I'm like, this makes no sense. If you're going to have a world record, why would you put it before the Diamond League window? Why would you have no one good in the meet except for one person? And I didn't look at the conditions yet, but the conditions weren't great last year. It seems probably going to be too warm. But I'm like, hey, okay, let's just make sure. John texts the agent. Agent specifically says she's not going for the world record. And then John privately tells me before we start the podcast, I bet she's going for the world record. No. She's not going for the world record.
Okay, we'll make a note of this segment on the podcast, Robert, because, you know, here's the two things people are trying to struggle to comprehend. Why would Letessa Mbakide fly to China to run an event? This is a non-Diamond League 5K. That's not why it's not in the TV window, Robert, because it's going to take a while for it to happen. Now, I guess the explanation there is her management, Global Sports Communication, they're the ones who are staging this meet. So maybe they paid her some appearance fee to show up. But I think you could also say, well, they are able to organize this field, and she didn't run well cross country this year to focus on the track. Like, why would you show up to run? Why would you fly all the way to China to run a 5K? I guess that's the thinking. And you just think they're paying her a bunch of money to show up to run an event that won't be even on the broadcast window, Robert?
Correct. If her agency is in charge of the meet and they thought she was going to break the world record when they put it on TV, and I've always thought about this.
No, they wouldn't. Hey, that happens a lot.
Fair enough. But meet directors, another brilliant idea by Rojo. I'll admit the first half of a 5,000 is boring on TV. You can go to TV. You can go to commercial. But the one way to start the Diamond League and make it fun, You have no live stream. There's no video. There's nothing. You announce there's a world record attempt. You start it 7 minutes before the TV window comes up. Everybody knows they have to turn on the TV. And you watch the second half right as the show starts as they chase the world record. I think that if you're going to run the 5,000, you start the first half of it off air. It doesn't take very much time. Remember a couple years ago, they were like, we're going to get rid of the 5,000, put a 3,000 in. No, it's not the same as the 5,000. The 5,000 is a better event. You just don't have to put it on TV. Just start it at 9:50. It's 6:55 and then turn on the TV at 7 o'clock.
Okay. Well, just for the record, they have Wave Light at this meet. I'm going to be very interested to see what they set the paces for. And also, Jakob Ingebrigtsen, when he set his 2-mile world record in Paris last year, that was a non-Diamond League event outside the TV window. So there is precedent for this sort of thing. Her agency is just saying she's not running for time. We'll see what happens on Saturday. I'm still excited to see G-Day race. It's her outdoor opener.
Her agency running the meet slightly changes the equation, but I'm still not ruling out this world record. And if we have a world record, we're likely going to get the first sub 14, 13 minute women's 5K. In a pre, you're likely to see the first 28 minute women's 10K with Sagai going for the world record there. So it's going to be a historic year for women's track and field running. I feel confident both records will be broken this year.
Yeah, first sub 29 on the track, because remember we had two women go sub 29 on the roads already in Valencia this year. Shifting stateside, let's talk about Christian Miller. This is amazing. I always looked at the 10-second 100-meter barrier for high schoolers as like one of the last remaining holy grails in high school running. Until last year, no high schooler had ever done it. And then Issama Singa did break 10 seconds last summer, but there are a whole bunch of caveats attached to that. He did it at the end of July at the South American Championships after graduating, representing Suriname. And then he was later suspended for testing positive for a banned substance. That whole case, he's provisionally suspended. That whole case is still ongoing. So it was just like, that's not really the most satisfying way to see the 10-second barrier fall. This one, Christian Miller, there's no doubt about it. He's runs 9.93 at the Pure Athletics Spring Invitational at Claremont. That's the same meet that Asinga beat Noah Lyles last year. He's 17 years old. He's still in high school, hasn't graduated yet. Creekside High School in St. John's, Florida, outside of Jacksonville. He's the youngest man in history to break 10 seconds. Not only that, he's the youngest by almost a full year. He was 17 years, 340 days old when he broke it. Issama Singa was 18 years, 211 days when he did it. And he was the previous youngest last summer. And this is not some like out of nowhere. I mean, it was a sizable PB. Claremont, you can run fast with a big win there. It's a good track. But he ran 10.06 last year when he won the 100 at the USA Under 20 Championships. That was a world under 18 record. Now he's set the US Under 20 record and is also the 2024 world leader. And yes, it's only April 20th, but just amazing. Like, it's very exciting. He's going to be at the Olympic trials this summer. Basically by default, not he'd be running anyway, but there is no, the US is not sending a team to the World Under 20 Championships. So he cannot run that even if he wanted to. But it's going to be really exciting to see how Miller does the rest of this outdoor season.
I mean, this is nuts. When Asinga last year was talking about, like, you know, being a factor at Worlds, I was like, a high school kid? Now, it's way harder in this case because There's no way he can make the Olympic team, right? I say that, yet he's the world leader. So today's age, you can't rule anything out. I want some sprint guy to tell me, how are these young kids so much faster? You're not seeing the top end sprint times be that much better. I know there's slightly different shoe technology, but not as much as in the distance running. But man, the future is bright for this kid. He's a Georgia commit. And I guess now NIL, you can get some money in college, but the question for him immediately is like, is he actually going to go to Georgia?
Well, you say there's no way he could make the Olympic team.
What?
I mean, I think it's incredibly hard. This is the hardest Olympic team to make in any country in the 100 meters. It's one of the hardest Olympic teams to make, period. You have lost three world champions in this event. Noah Lyles, Fred Curley, and Christian Coleman. But 993 would have put him number 7 on the U.S. list in 2023. That's a finalist. And, you know, if you get some injuries in there, like, his chances aren't zero, which is insane to say for a 17-year-old. I don't think they're good, but they're not zero.
Robert's got a look of disbelief on his face here.
I was kind of barely paying attention while I was looking up some stats. Then I heard someone say his chances are close to zero for the Olympics. Are you crazy? Does your memory go back at least 3 years? Do you remember what happened 3 years ago? The Tokyo Olympics.
Arian Knighton made the Olympic team. He finished fourth at the Olympics as a 17-year-old high school junior. I don't think I said they were close to zero. I said they're not zero. And I wouldn't bet on him making the team. But
this is good for me.
He's a freak talent. Like, could he make the team? Knighton would be your example, right, Robert?
Correct. And my Noah Lyles fear meter is going down by the minute. This is great for me. I just need three guys to peak in June at the trials. Over peak. You get your peak 100% right, make the team, knock Noah Lyles off the 100 team. Then I, you know, whatever. So this guy's amazing.
And then you go down as a horrible human being for rooting for Noah Lyles not to make the Olympic team just because you make some crazy bet on or proclamation on Let's Run. But I'm the one who said there's no way he makes it, meaning essentially like there is a way he makes it. Like it's hard for me to fathom that a high school kid could do it, but Knighton is a great example. I'm just saying you're in the equation if you run 993. But then if you go there, John, you make the U.S. team in the 100. I mean, like, you got to think you can win the gold medal. I mean, that's the next step. So we're getting ahead of ourselves. The kid is 17. Can we just appreciate the sub 10? Like, but I love it. I guess maybe, yeah, I still want to know from somebody, because we say, oh, Bolt was a once-a-generation talent. Knighton's a once-a-generation talent. Asinga, okay, there's some situations going on there, but there's a threat in Let's Run saying he may be cleared. And now, Miller?
Yeah, no, if you look at the list of the four youngest men ever to break 10 seconds, three of the four have done it in the last 3 years. It was Tobogo in 2022, it was Asinga last year, and now it's Christian Miller this year. And I think you got to put this performance into context. The spin on, like, he could get even better is he's 17, he just made a huge improvement, like, he might not be done improving. I think he'll run faster at some point in his career. It might not be again in 2024. But then the other thing is, it's Claremont, which is, he had a nice tailwind for this. It's a pretty fast track. And it's April. You know, if you want to be competing, still running fast at the end of June, that, you know, you got to hold that level for a while. Now, I will say, he ran his best time of the year last year at the U.S. Under 20 Championships at the end of the season. So I think his whatever coaching setup, they seem to figure it out pretty well last year. But you can make the case both ways. I'm just excited to see how he does. There's no doubting he's a monster talent.
I wonder how the college commitment thing works. I should know, since I was coaching at Cornell, I didn't care about the signing window. If him, I want to get paid twice if I go to college. I want NIL money from the boosters to actually go to the college. So, you know, because if you go to Georgia or LSU, by the way, when he announced it live, he had all these hats on the thing, and then he took off his jacket or something. He showed LSU purple colors. Everyone started cheering, thought he was going to LSU, and then underneath that, he had Georgia stuff. So I feel bad for the LSU coaches who thought they had him for about 10 seconds. But I'm assuming he can't renegotiate. I want to get the NIL from the boosters, and then I want to get the NIL from the shoe companies as well. I talked to someone last year about Asinga. They were speculating, do you really want to pay $1 million for a Singo to be on your track team. Now, I don't know if that meant like per year or over 4 years. I'm assuming it's over 4 years. But kind of guaranteed like 20 points in NCAAs definitely tips you. You're almost halfway to the team title. That may seem crazy, but I was at a birthday party at the zoo on Sunday. By the way, I ran into a guy who's a Supporters Club member, father of a kid in my son's school. Glad to have you on board. I have to get in shape to run with him, John. But this other dad was saying that he was from overseas. He's like, yeah, American colleges are crazy. This lady that I work with, her son, he got a full scholarship for lacrosse. And I think he's going to like George Mason or George Washington, James Madison, something like that. And then he said, and he's getting $200,000. I was like, for lacrosse? Because I keep calling these college coaches, and they act like they're not paying much NIL for track, if any. Then I hear from other people they are. I did hear someone say to me, another coach told me, he's like, this is all going to end poorly soon, because these boosters are not going to want to be paying out $200,000 every year.
Well, lacrosse is also a sport that sort of has a reputation for rich alums, right? That's viewed as sort of a white-collar sport. So, I don't know. Actually, while we're on this topic, Robert, of money, should we just go to the Mark Zuckerberg 5K? You sent me a text the other day, and it was a screenshot of an article saying Mark Zuckerberg, the 39-year-old CEO of Meta, ran 20:58 for 5K on Sunday. And your line was, how is this real? And I don't understand that at all. You run a very popular running website. Does the idea of a guy running a 20:58 5K at age 39, how does that not make sense to you? What's confusing about this?
I was making fun of y'all's memory not being good going back 3 years. Mine didn't even go back a year. I had the same conversation last year when this dude ran a 19:34 5,000. Just can't believe this nerdy, I thought kind of fat, pudgy guy is significantly faster than me and a lot of the Let's Run audience. Speaking of NIL, well, did y'all hear this?
Zuck, if you're listening, because you know he probably wants to be known as an athlete and stuff. Zuck, if you're listening, can you make sure that like this cookie listing in the browser is not a good thing for small independent publishers? Can you help independent publishers out? A lot of these things, I think, are just designed to entrench the big companies. So help the little guys out, Zuck. Thank you. Appreciate it. Good luck.
I should call
him.
I'm
going to California soon. That's all I'm going to say.
I should make fun of him. I'm actually amazed that this guy, this busy with kids, is running this fast. He's pretty talented, to be honest, at that age. So, super impressive. But what stunned me was I sent a text message congratulating Weldon's college teammate, Matt Taylor, the founder of Tracksmith, because Zuck's wearing a Tracksmith shirt. I was like, this was an amazing signing. How much did you guys pay him? He's like, you won't believe it. We got him for only $650,000 a year. So they snooped in, got him ahead of Nike, got ahead of Adidas. Every Silicon Valley bro, myself, I'm going to go re-up my Tracksmith stuff.
Robin, the whole thing about this, though, you're acting as if it's some, like you're just comparing him to yourself. You're acting as if it's some crazy revelation that a guy who actually runs several times per week and is more than 10 years younger is faster than a guy who doesn't run basically at all and is older. Like, that's what this situation boils down to.
I think the average Let's Runner vastly overrates what the average American is. I do not think that the average American, I think they could train their entire life at age 39, could train full time with professionals and not break 19:34. Now, I know that's what he ran last year, but I think that's a sign of talent that most Americans don't have. And I just believe this guy's got this amazing programming talent, business talent, and running talent. By the way, folks, I was joking about the Tracksmith stuff. I have not texted Matt Taylor to see if they have him on a secret NIL deal or not.
Well, we're talking about billionaires running fast. Sir Jim Ratcliffe, I think he's the chairman or CEO of Ineos.
And Let's Run Circles, they were known for putting on, you know, the sub two that actually happened. I guess we should have known. This guy's a legit runner, like big running fan. He ran 4 hours, 32 minutes, 52 seconds. I think he's 71 years old at the London Marathon. Then he quickly went over to the FA Cup semifinal to watch Manchester United win a crazy game. He's hoping Manchester United makes as much progress as Crystal Palace has made in just the last few months. He'll be looking up next year, Jim, but congratulations for the running accomplishments, at least.
While we're talking about rich men, let me talk about another rich man, Max Siegel, man who I think is grossly overpaid to run USATF, but who the board thinks is so brilliant he deserves millions of dollars in bonuses, even though he did not index his Nike deal for inflation. Nike's going to be laughing in 2040 when they're barely paying anything for that. The rate the dollar's going up or down or whatever. But when the recent U.S. Olympic marathon trials were awarded, Max Siegel, for the second time in three Olympic cycles, just overrid the recommendations of the committee and said, we're putting them in Orlando. And he ruled out Chattanooga because he claimed that Jim Estes, a USATF board member, had worked on the Chattanooga bid. It was just too huge of a conflict of interest and no one knew about this and da-da-da. When in reality, Jim Estes had told everyone, hey, I'm doing this. This is okay. No one said anything. And anyways, Jim Estes now has lost his consulting business and has sued Max Siegel and some others for defamation. Max Siegel tried to get that lawsuit thrown out. And I've got news to report. Judge has just issued a ruling saying, no, no, we're not throwing this out. And I've been told that now Mr. Siegel might have to get a little uncomfortable. Discovery's going to start. They can look at emails. You can't be asked under oath, hey, why did you move the trials to Orlando? Why did you want them there? Do you have any, are there any conflict of interest with you in your dealings with USATF? Why did you move the trials to Houston in 2016? All these things.
Trials were moved to LA from Houston in 2016, Robert, just for the record. Not moved, but they, you know, there was a recommendation for Houston. They gave them to LA.
So hopefully some of the insider, I don't know, just hopefully we get a little bit of the secrecy of USATF, the peek at it. And I imagine this is going to make them very uncomfortable. They may not want to peek at it. They may just settle.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting, Robert, if this thing ends up going to trial. I'm guessing it probably won't. Often these sort of things are settled. But if it does go to trial, to see Max Siegel, other folks at USATF talk a bit more openly about this whole trials process, why Orlando was given the nod over Chattanooga. I think we should note here there were four counts that Jim Estes brought in this lawsuit against USATF and Max Siegel, and three of them were dismissed. One was defamation by Max Siegel, sort of out just as a person. The other one was defamation by USATF through Max Siegel. That's the one that was not dismissed. So that's the one that would be, you know, on trial here. And then the last two were negligence by Renee Washington, who's the COO of USATF, negligence by USATF. Those two were dismissed as well.
And Jim Estes is still on the USATF board? Or is he off it now?
No, he resigned from his position on the USATF board a few months ago, I believe.
Okay, that's probably the best. But actually, one problem with the board is these boards take on a life of their own on a board. And just at some point, they kind of have an organizational momentum. A few people may not agree with everything, but even if you disagree, like your disagreement is really probably not going to be seen by the general public. But if you look, the board just, I don't know, it'd be a better job if they sort of did a better job of communicating with the constituents that there might be actually some debate about some of these things. But this case, I assume, is going to settle.
Well, also, USATF has countersued Jim Estes about this whole thing. So, yeah, my guess is there's some sort of settlement here. But, yeah, it's notable that the judge ruled that Estes' claim should move forward and that not everything was dismissed.
I assume if USATF were to lose, they would be covered by insurance. Like, because they don't have a lot of money to give away. And I guess I need to read these documents. We'll link to this one. I'd love to see how Jim is accused of defaming USATF. At least on this merits, it seems like the judge allowing the case to go forward, that there's a decent case to be made on Jim's behalf.
We'll link to the whole PDF. I think this is just good for anyone who's for transparency, that the lawsuit is continuing to go. Maybe we'll get some of this in public record.
Speaking of lawsuits, there's some saber rattling going on. We may have one soon between USADA and WADA. That would be U.S. Anti-Doping and World Anti-Doping. The New York Times and the German broadcasters,
ARD,
broke this story. But 23 Chinese swimmers tested positive for this performance-enhancing drug called, well, it's abbreviated TMZ.
Trimetazidine. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but it's the same one Kamila Valieva, the Russian figure skater at the 2022 Olympics. It's a heart medication, but it's popping up in a lot of positive tests these days.
We might need to get Ross Tucker on for this one. But so they all tested positive in early 2021 and this never came out essentially until
a bunch of Chinese swimmers here, a number of whom went on to great success at that summer's Olympics, and some of whom will be competing at this summer's Olympics likely as well.
And essentially WADA's story is like, oh, the Chinese said it was contamination. That's why everyone tested positive. We bought that excuse, so we didn't need to release this. Travis Tygart, the head of USADA, is having none of it. He said on April 20th, it's crushing to see that 23 Chinese swimmers had positive tests for a potent performance-enhancing drug on the eve of the 2021 Olympic Games, as reported by the New York Times. It's even more devastating to learn the World Anti-Doping Agency and the Chinese Anti-Doping Agency secretly, until now, swept these positives under the carpet by failing to fairly and evenly follow the global rules that apply to everyone else in the world. WADA, like immediately, same day, came blasting out with a response, defending themselves, and then saying, it should be noted, following Mr. Tygart's false allegations, WADA has no choice but to refer this matter to its legal counsel for further action. Tygart fired back again, essentially saying, when you blow away the rhetoric, the facts remain as has been reported. WADA failed to provisionally suspend the athletes, disqualify results, and publicly disclose the positives. These are egregious failures. Even if you buy their story that this was contamination and a potent drug, quote, magically appeared, unquote, in a kitchen and led to 23 positives of lowly Chinese swimmers. What say you guys?
Well, Travis Tygart and WADA have sort of been at odds a little bit the last few years anyway, and this seems to be something that could really, well, it already has blown into something bigger. It was just a constant war of words on Friday. But the issue to me boils down to, like, how should these positive tests be handled in the global anti-doping community? And USADA, they're fairly firm on this. They say, if you test positive for a banned substance, we're going to announce that. And if it's a case where we believe it's contamination, we'll look at the evidence. We will try to figure out what happened. And when we announce it, we'll say, okay, we investigated it. We concluded it's a contamination. They're not going to serve a ban, but they'll be issued with a warning or a no-fault finding, because they believe in transparency and saying, hey, this person had a banned substance in the system. We don't believe it was there nefariously, but we need to announce it. And WADA and the Chinese anti-doping agency, in this case, they knew they had a bunch of positive tests, and they're saying, well, we don't think they were guilty, so there was no reason to announce it at all. And in this sort of situation, I think I'm on the side of Tygart. I would rather know if there's a banned substance in a system, particularly one that does appear to be abused by athletes. I'd like to know about that and be able to form our own judgments rather than just have it not come out at all, especially when it's that widespread.
23 athletes.
This is simple to me. I don't care if it's 23 athletes, one athlete. What does the rule say? What do the procedures say? Tiger's alleging that they have to announce it. But it seems to me, right, in the past, haven't they not announced it for other people? Because wasn't that what Shelby Houlihan was trying to do? Like, it's kind of ironic because Tiger has let a lot of people off on, like, I kiss my boyfriend type of excuses, but it still gets announced. I believe on the Houlihan case, they were trying to rush things through because they thought she'd be cleared and then nobody would ever know about it. Because USADA wasn't handling that. The internationals were handling it. So do we know what the rule book is? Because he's very clearly saying they didn't follow protocol. And they're saying, we're going to sue you. Well,
I need to actually study the rules on this, because Water is saying we followed the correct procedures and it didn't need to be announced. And Kravis Tiger is saying, no, you didn't. You were supposed to announce this and this is failure to follow the rules. So I have to actually wade through like the Water code or the international testing standards to see what the actual process is supposed to be.
This doesn't seem like it should be debatable. Like in a case, if you're in a lawsuit, there's a thing called you ask for summary judgment. Like everyone knows what happened. It's just a matter of like, okay, what are the actual rules? Like, and I saw that press release from the internationals and they said, we would do it again exactly the same way. And he's saying clearly you violated protocol. So it shouldn't be that debatable to me.
Yeah, clearly there can be debate about simple rules and how they're interpreted. Hell, we lost a lawsuit once in summary judgment. I still think to this day we're totally in the right. But to me, I thought, you know, major positives had to be announced if you didn't clear people. But Robert points out Houlihan, a good example. But the rules should be something like this, 23 athletes from one country, because this is either systematic doping or a horrific case of contamination that everyone needs to know about. But for the sake of transparency, I think the world deserves to know that this happened. So the rule, I hope, if it isn't, should be more along the Tiger, line of things, because there's only two explanations for this. Systematic doping was going on, or somehow these athletes all got a heart contamination drug, took a heart contamination drug while at a hotel. Like maybe there's science behind that, but that seems a bit, hard to believe for a lot of people, but either way, I think it's important enough and enough athletes that it somehow should come out. But I guess the lawyers will debate what the actual rule is.
Correct, because it's either massive doping on a massive scale or this like air vent was messed up. And it's just really unfortunate. But it's China and then they're secretive about it.
Right, and this whole thing is tricky because this is the height of COVID and China. It was end of 2020 into 2021. And
you nailed it.
Well, height of the COVID restrictions. And USAID is basically saying WADA needs to investigate this more. They're taking the word of the Chinese agency that, you know, they looked into it and they discovered it was contamination. But USAID itself, they have all these questions in their press release that came out today on Tuesday. China did not determine the source of the TMC, and WADA apparently did not raise the obvious questions. How did a controlled drug, TMZ, arrive in the kitchen? Did any kitchen staff have a prescription or use TMZ? Did an employee crush TMZ pills while in the kitchen? Was CCTV footage reviewed? I mean, I think those are fair questions because it was a very low level. I think we're talking about picograms, but it was a level in a bunch of people's systems. So, yeah, I think I can understand why they want more information about this case. But yeah, USADA is calling, now they're calling for like an overhaul of water, an independent regulator to look into all of this. So yeah, we'll see how this all shakes out. Speaking of the anti-doping movement, we had another interesting piece of news break on Tuesday morning. L'Équipe in France had this, that Pierre Ambroise Boss, who is the 2017 world champion in the 800 meters, was handed a one-year whereabouts ban. And I read this and I'm like, okay, but yeah, but didn't he retire in December? So, you know, I kind of thought like, oh, maybe it's just a guy, once he retired, he stopped really caring about where he was. And he was handed this ban that isn't going to affect anything. But then I looked to the details of the case, that's actually not what happened.
his three whereabouts failures were in September 2022, May 2023, and June 2023. And that was when he was still trying to compete. He was dealing with this hamstring injury. But, you know, when he announced his retirement at the end of December last year, he said, yeah, it's a hamstring injury. It's bothering me. I've lost the joy for the sport. It's not allowing me to run anymore. He didn't mention he was staring at a two-year whereabouts suspension, which, you know, is ultimately reduced to one. Now, he's accepted responsibility. He came out, he said, look, there was a doorbell issue and he wasn't in a good place because this injury had just derailed his career. And he was really stressed about that. But then he said at the end of the story, I made three mistakes. I accept it is true that I have not always been the best student when it comes to taking care of my location. But until then, it had never played any tricks on me. I know I should have been more serious, but I would like to point out that I've been in the French doping agency testing target group since 2012 and they have all my analyses. So what do you guys make of all of this?
I guess I should really care because maybe the 2017 world champion was missing tests on purpose, but my thing is like, he's out of the sport. I don't really care. I don't know. I'm willing to sort of maybe accept his word at it, but it's not going to impact anything going forward. He's not competing anymore. So.
Well, you say it's not going to impact anything going forward, but he is a former world champion. Like, I guess this is one of those cases where I just look at it. I'm like, was it carelessness, recklessness, or was he actually missing tests to cover up doping? And, you know, a lot of these times we just simply don't know. But I did find it notable that this came while he was still trying to compete rather than, you know, after he had officially retired.
It kind of reminds me of Mary Slaney. If he did he only do it at the end of his career when he was desperate and wanted to make the home Olympics? Or was he doing it all along when he ran 142 at age 22? And it just, I don't know. I guess we'll never know who's clean. But this raises the odds that he was doping to me. Just like when one of Kipchoge's training partners says positive, raises the odds for me. And this is much more, raises them much more than a training partner. But even if you get cleared, makes me more suspicious. Gabby Thomas, two missed tests. Ajay Wilson, Jurrien Lawson. I know they were cleared, but that's why I'm for full transparency. You miss one damn test, they should put it on a database. Let me see it.
So here's the whole argument about what we were talking about in the WADA USADA thing, because Travis Tygart's saying there needs to be transparency in all these cases. We need to be reporting it. But then you still doubt these athletes more, even if it comes out that they're cleared. The fact that their name is announced at all, you're more suspicious of them.
So what? Just because you get not guilty in a criminal trial doesn't mean you didn't do it. It just means there wasn't evidence proof. There wasn't enough evidence to convict you. That's the way the world works. But I'd rather know that Mo Farah missed two tests than not. But that's just me. I'm kind of more for transparency. Also, to me, I would also use like statistical. If everybody in one training group is getting two missed tests, that would be enough for me. I'd be okay. And they can claim they're clean, but I, deep down, at least in my heart, I know they're dirty.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this week's episode. We will eagerly await the announcements on the Kenyan and Ethiopian Olympic marathon teams. I assume the Ethiopian one, you might actually have to wait because Goyetom Gebreselassie, who won the 2022 world title, she's running in Hamburg this weekend. So we may actually have to wait until, if she wins that or she runs really fast, she might still have a chance to make the team. So that news should be coming out relatively soon. We've got the pen relays this weekend. We've got the
Drake relays.
We've got the Suzhou Diamond League. So there's more track this weekend if you want it. And then after that, we got world relays the weekend after that.
Wait, we forgot to talk about Josh Kerr, 145.9 opener. I said, he better be able to run 146. This is only the third time he's ever run 145. To me, it's just everything this guy's been. And he said he wanted to run faster and he killed everybody in the race. Second place is 147. To me, it's just like everything this guy's been doing so far this year has been perfect. Like 2 mile world record, dominates world indoors, now this.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were saying after his indoor season, he said it himself, he's in a better spot than he was, you know, that time 12 months ago. So I agree with you, Robert. He has not put a foot wrong yet. If he stays healthy, he's going to be tough to beat in Paris. But there are a lot of other good guys in that event too. I mean, Jakob's going to be tough to beat. A lot of people are going to be tough to beat.
One last thing about the Shanghai Diamond League.
Suzhou. It's they're calling it Shanghai, but it's in Suzhou. That it's weird.
Oh, okay.
It's like when they had the Rome Diamond League in Florence.
Looks like it would be about 68 degrees at the start of the women's 5,000. It seems to me if you're going for a world record, wouldn't you put it at the, after the meet when it's cooler? But G'day's talented. We'll see if there's a 13 next time we talk. We'll probably go live after the meet, after the Diamond League's over, right? On Saturday morning, 9 o'clock.
Sounds like a good idea. All right. Till then, thanks for tuning in, everyone. Rate and review 5 stars if you haven't already. We'd love to see those.
And if you want the Diamond League podcast, letsrun.com/subscribe. Use code CLUB25, save 25%. And you always need a VPN. letsrun.com/VPN. Get the one we use, Nord, money back guarantee.